Today's Taisho is on Case 28 in the Mumonkan. Ryutan blows out the candle. Tokusan asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late. Why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan went through a deep experience and made bows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Tokusan, "I will not doubt the words of an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick and he won't even turn his head to look at you. Some day or other he will climb the highest peaks and establish our way there." Tokusan brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front hall, pointed to them with a torch, and said, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a hair on your head in vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripped in the green ocean." And he burned all his notes. Then, making his bows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment. Before Tokusan crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrine of the special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Rishu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship," the old woman said, "what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Tokusan. The old woman said, "I hear it is said in that sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to have refreshed?" At this question, Tokusan was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here you will find Ryutan Osho." Coming to Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all sense of shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse, "Hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name." He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful day and practicing the Great Way. Thank you so much for coming. You know, I I wonder if you know why you came. Why did you come here? Why did you come here? You know, if you ask yourself that question honestly, why did you come here? It might surprise you to realize that you don't know why you came here. You could say, well, I got up to sit. But why did you come to sit? You know, why? And if you say, well, I've been under a lot of stress lately, probably that's not why you came to sit. You know, there's lots of ways to deal with your stress. If you say, well, I'm practicing because I want to become enlightened, that's great, but what does it mean to become enlightened? You know? So, you know, it's an interesting fact that people got up on a Saturday and came here to sit. And if you ask yourself, why did I do this, it's probably the case that most of the answers you give are really alibis. And that the answer to the question, why do you come here, is one you really don't know. And I think that's quite important and actually wonderful. You know, if somebody has a job, say they're an architect, and they, they're designing houses, you know, they probably, have spent the week drawing up plans for building or inspecting a construction site and looking at the construction. They know why they are doing what they're doing, right? I mean, they go out, I'm driving out to the site because I want to make sure that the plans are being faithfully executed, or because there's a question about the location of the window, right? Often in life, we are doing things that we have reasons for, right? I mean, I'm going to go to a conference in a little while, in about a month, and I have to get my paper ready. And if somebody asked me, why am I writing the paper, I would say, well, I'm trying to get ready for the conference. If I have to take my car into GT Automotive next week, I highly recommend them. They're very good if you have a Japanese car. They're very reliable. And I'm taking my car in next week. If somebody asks me, why are you taking your car in? You know, obviously, I'm the check engine light is coming on, so I'm going to have them check the engine. But, you know, when it comes to getting up on a Saturday morning when you could have slept in and coming here to sit, that's really different. Because I would guess that you really don't know why you came. And I think, as I said, that's really important. It's really important to get in touch with the part of yourself that doesn't know why. When I was in college as an undergraduate, I had to take 5 classes every semester, you know, because that's how many credits I needed to graduate in 4 years. You know, when I got out of college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with myself. You know, I didn't think that I wanted to go to graduate school. So a friend and I hitchhiked across the United States, and we went on a summer-long hiking trip in the Southwest. And, the truth is, I didn't really have any objective other than to experiment, I didn't know where this was going to take me. I didn't stand to benefit from it in any way. I couldn't put on a CV, hitchhiked across the United States, basically camped out 100 nights in a row, right? It was coming from a different place, You know, we often live from the place where we know what we're supposed to do, or we know what we think we want to do, right? But there's this other source of motivation, which we Zen people believe is a deeper place, deeper motivation. You know, if I've been practicing Zen for 40 years, so can't say why I have been practicing Zen for 40 years, except that I really want to practice. I really love this practice. Very liberating. But if somebody said, how is it liberating, it would be difficult to say. Difficult to say. I haven't made any money from Zen practice, right? So I have a job at Rutgers, and every 2 weeks they put an amount of money in my bank account, and I use that to pay the mortgage on the house I live in, buy groceries, pay for car repairs at GT Automotive. Zen is there's no remuneration, right? You're not going to make any money. You can't really parlay your Zen career into running for president or becoming a full professor, right? You know, lots of people on Saturday morning are going to get up and maybe in the academic world, they're going to work on their article and publish another article so they can add that to their CV and then they can become a professor. You know, if you that's a noble thing to do. I totally applaud it. But actually, this is nothing like that, because you can't put this on your CV. You can't point to this as an accomplishment that's going to get you a lot of recognition or approval from others. In fact, on the contrary, you know, it may often be the case that when you tell people what you do, they look at you oddly, right? So, you know, I meditate every day, and we do sitting here 3 times a week, once on Sunday morning, and every other Saturday here as well. So I put in a lot of time meditating. And I also meditate on my own, you know, just for my own practice. And sometimes I meditate 2 and even 3 hours a day. I mean, if you get up at 5, it's easier to do, right? And sometimes people have heard about this. You know, they say, I understand you teach Zen, and I'll say, yes, I teach Zen. And they'll say, do you meditate? I say, oh, I meditate every day. How many hours a day? I say, I don't know. You know, sometimes I meditate 2 or 3 hours. And they look at me like I'm insane. If I said I meditate, I watch TV 2 hours a day, nobody would think that was odd, right? You know, when I got interested in Zen, my father was very disapproving of this. That was probably one of the reasons I decided to do it, you know. But he was very disapproving of this. And then when I was in graduate school, my graduate director was very disapproving of this. You know, he said, he found out, he said, you're doing what, you know? Basically he said, that's time you could be spending on your research. You know, are you crazy? So lots of people warned me off of doing this. So it's not a case where you can parlay this into something that's going to benefit you, you know. So why are you doing it? Why are you doing it? And the fact that you might not be able to say is terribly important. It's terrifically important. I'll get to the why in a little while. But let's go back to the story at the heart of this koan. The main character is called Tokusan. And that is his the name he was called at the temple where he was studying with old Ryotan. So the student is Tokusan and the master is Ryotan. Okay. Now before Tokusan was Tokusan, he was called Shu. His name was Shu, and he was a scholar of Buddhist sutras. In fact, his specialty was the Diamond Sutra. Some of you may have read the Diamond Sutra. If you haven't read it, I urge you to read it. It's a wonderful, beautiful sutra. And it's a key inspiration for Zen. The Diamond Sutra is one of the key sutras in the Zen tradition. So this man, Shu, was a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and he was famous for knowing everything about the Diamond Sutra. If you picked a reference in the Diamond Sutra, he would say, oh yes, that phrase comes from this place in India. It means this. The Sanskrit word is this. The Pali word is that. And so on. And the difficult philosophical concepts he could explain with ease. And he was so adept at explicating the Diamond Sutra that he became known as Diamond Shu. His name was Shu, and he became Diamond Shu. So Diamond Shu was a famous scholar of Buddhism in his time, and he was accorded all of these honors, you know, the kind of honors that you would be accorded if you were a famous scholar. So, you know, at Rutgers, you get a promotion basically every time you publish a book. So if you're an assistant professor and you publish a book, you get to be associate professor. If you publish another book, you get to be assistant professor. If you publish another book, you get to be a distinguished professor. After that, there's no other titles, right? But they give you raises, actually, if you keep publishing, you know. So I don't think anybody writes a book just to get a raise, but I definitely think that, it's a system that's designed to promote productivity. People are supposed to put out the books, put out the articles. And actually, I'm very glad they do. You know, there's so much good work. I read a lot of Buddhist scholarship, and I'm amazed at the quality, you know. I was just reading a book the other day, and I thought, this is so good. It's by a professor at Princeton, and it's brilliant. And I'm so glad he wrote it. It was so wonderful. This professor is an expert in Buddhist psychology. So he would be, his name is Silver, and he would be called Buddhist Psychology Silver if he got famous enough. So Diamond Shu is like that. He's done all of these things that make total sense. They make total sense, right? I mean, in this period of Chinese history, Buddhism was like physics. Physics. So if you want to impress people, if you go to a party and you want to impress people, you know, the way to impress them is to say, what do I study? I study physics, right? People will just go, oh my God, you're a genius, right? The world is full of physicists who aren't geniuses, but I think most of us think of physics as like the top of the heap, right? That's the most, it could be, there's Einstein. You know, physics is very hard to understand. Quarks, what are quarks? Black holes, you know. When you trot out a physicist, everybody's filled with respect, right? So, you know, and physics is, in a certain way, very advanced knowledge, right? If I say, Yes, I'm an English professor. People are, you know, they're mildly amused, right? But if I were to say, I'm a physicist, they, oh my God, what are you doing? You know, I probably can't even understand it, but just tell me, right? You know. And I can tell them about, you know, something. I can't even imagine what it would be. So physics is like the top thing. It's the most, in our culture, it's what we think of as the most advanced knowledge. Maybe number two is like brain science, right? Right now, brain science is so hot. So if you say to somebody, oh, you know, I actually work on poetry. You know, I work on poetic structures. It's like, you know, they look for a drink if you're at a party. But if you say, you know, I work on the brain, it's like they won't leave you alone, right? They have to hear about the brain, that's so cool, right? So physics is number one, brain science is number two. So in Chinese civilization at this time, actually Buddhism was thought to be like the physics of the time, really and truly. Yeah, I've mentioned this before, but you know, ancient China, or China at this time, wasn't really ancient, but in the Tang Dynasty, it was a little bit like Tibet was until recently, right? So I've mentioned that all over China there were what were called public temples, which are like public universities. So only the difference was the public temples were free, and very few public universities in America are free, probably none. But the Chinese were so serious about enlightenment that they created a whole structure where of public temples where you could go and present your papers, your ordination papers, and if you were a monk or nun in good standing with the Sangha, you would be given a room, you would be told, please be in the Zendo at 5 o'clock for Zazen, and the Sesshin is next week, right? And you would show up for the Sesshin. And the stories of Zen masters all involve many of them, like Joshu, traveling around China at these public temples and having encounters with other teachers or other students of Zen. So they took it really seriously. And, you know, somebody like Diamond Shu would have been super respected, right? So, you know, if somebody said in that time, oh, I'm a specialist on the Diamond Sutra, the sutra that says form is emptiness and emptiness is form, people would all want to be your friend, right? That's fascinating. Tell me more, right? And the Chinese took this very seriously. You know, all the sutras that traveled from India to China were very, very, very carefully translated. You know, there were like committees of scholars who went through every word to make sure that it was accurate. And so they took all of this quite seriously. You know, the Chinese translations from the Sanskrit are meticulous. Even today, people are in awe of how carefully done they were. So the record keeping is excellent. So in India, not so much. Interestingly, you know, the Indian record keeping is not very good, but the Chinese record keeping is meticulous. So you know, Diamond Shu was a very important person, and he had done had a brilliant career, right? And he is at a conference basically for Diamond Sutra scholars or Buddhist scholars, and he hears somebody say that there's a sect of Buddhism called Zen, Chan, and they believe in a transmission outside the sutras. And in other words, Chan people believe that it's important to read the sutras, but reading the sutras is not the same thing as practicing the Great Way. So it's important to read the sutras, but you cannot become enlightened by reading the sutras. It cannot happen. It will not happen. You can read the sutras forever and you will not become enlightened. That's the Zen view. And in fact, even if you have a very sketchy knowledge of the sutras, you can have a great awakening experience. So when Diamond Shu heard about this, he was outraged, and you can understand why. You know, a friend of mine is a doctor, and he gets very upset. I have a circle of friends, and some of them are, well, he's a doctor, but in my circle of friends there are these people who believe in like alternative treatments, right? Alternative medicine. And my friend is not open to alternative medicine. So somebody will tell him that they're doing something and it will send him up the wall, right? It's like, that's, you know, that's not going to work, you know, that's ridiculous, that's not, that's voodoo, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, Diamond Shu is sort of like that. When he hears that about the Zen sect saying that you can't wake up by studying the sutras, that the path to enlightenment is a different path, he gets very upset. And he actually says, you know, these people are heretics, and I'm going to crush them. I'm going to demonstrate how wrong they are, right? So he decides to go to the part of China at this time where Zen was flourishing. And he packs up some of his sutras in a big basket. Like in those days they had like backpacks that were made out of baskets. You'll see Chinese illustrations of pilgrims and travelers with these, like they look like backpacks, only they're made of wicker, you know, instead of canvas. And he had his wicker backpack filled with his sutras and his commentaries and his notes on the sutras, right? And he was going to go and challenge the abbot at this temple, you know, basically challenge the leaders of the Zen sect and humiliate them in public and show them to be a bunch of idiots. Anyway, he sets off to do battle, but he's not exactly sure where he's going. He's going to this region in China where Zen was flourishing. And he's been traveling for many days on the road. Of course, there were no cars in the Tang Dynasty. So, you know, he's on foot, and he gets to an inn. And he's at the inn, and he pauses to have, like, a snack. And the Chinese word for snack, one of the Mandarin words for snack is tian xin, tian xin. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but tian xin means literally mind refreshment. So he says to the woman of the establishment, my good woman, would you please get me some tian xin? And he thinks she's just somebody you would meet, you know, at a restaurant, a waitress at a restaurant. But she's actually somebody who's deeply awake. And she says to him, you know, what do you do? And he says, oh, I study the Diamond Sutra. Oh, the Diamond Sutra, what do you know? Well, let me ask you something. According to the Diamond Sutra, so she knows the Diamond Sutra, she says, it says, basically, one way to translate it is to say, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, future mind is ungraspable. So if all of those minds are ungraspable, what mind do you want to refresh? And he's stunned, because he's been reading those words for 30 years, but he doesn't know what they mean in a deeper sense, right? We know what mind means. We know what ungraspable means. But there's a different way to know things, right? There's a different way to know things. You know, I remember my first time climbing up Mount Rainier. I'd seen many pictures of Mount Rainier, and the photos all said Mount Rainier under them. So, you know, I thought I understood Mount Rainier until I went to Mount Rainier. And when I was in the presence of Mount Rainier, I realized this is ungraspable. It's ungraspable. See, I think that's a different way of knowing. See, so he had read these words for 30 years and had written treatises on them. But when the woman said, what mind are you talking about? He experienced the issue in a different way. You know, he realized, you know, I don't even know what mind is, right? I don't even know what mind is. And, you know, he entered what we could say is the ungraspable, the realm of the ungraspable. And that's a different way to experience the world. Now, if Diamond Shoe had been, you know, if Diamond Shoe's karma had been of a certain character, he would have dismissed her question and gone on with his folly, right? See, karma is not what people think, right? I mean, in America, we think karma means something like what goes around comes around, right? So, you know, basically, if you steal some dollar bills out of the tip jar when the barista isn't looking, right, you're going to get burned later on, right? That's the idea, right? But, you know, karma means that when we do things, we are either making ourselves more coarse, or we're making ourselves more open to the ungraspable. See? So you know, if I am afraid sometimes, and I'm anxious, and I have decided, or I have developed a habit of channeling my anxiety by expressing it through anger, right? I'm actually hurting myself as well as the other people around me, because I'm making a habit out of grasping, you could say, grasping. You know, people sometimes get mad when they're out of control, when they feel that control is slipping out of their hands. And, you know, that often happens to all of us, right? I mean, when we're frustrated, when we're worried, you know, we feel that control is slipping out of our hands. We get angry. That's a way of grasping the situation, right? Holding on, of controlling the situation. And that makes us coarse, like crude-spirited. Our intelligence is diminished when we respond to events in that way, because we can't be open to the possibilities, right? We make our world smaller when we respond by grasping. So when we stop grasping, it becomes possible to learn something new, right? Because it's possible to learn something new. Like, you know, if a baby is crying, one way to respond to that is to get really angry at the baby, which is crazy, right? But many people do that. You know, it's like, oh, that damn baby is crying again. Now, that's making you coarse, right? Coarse. You're trying to control the situation, but it's making you unintelligent. So, of course, somebody who wasn't threatened by having his peace of mind interrupted by the baby would say, I wonder why the baby is crying, right? And you don't know. And then you could try different things to figure out why the baby is crying. You wouldn't know where this is going, but it would be worth a try, right? You have to learn to communicate with the baby. And at some point, you might actually do something that not only stops the baby from crying, but changes you, right? Suddenly you realize, oh my God, this baby is so cute. I love this little baby. And now you're not trying to stop the noise, you're trying to make the baby happy. So you've gotten out of yourself and you're connected with this sentient being. See, this is like transforming your karma. This is what karma is. Now you're more intelligent. You're more open. You know, but you have to be willing to tolerate the ungraspable. The ungraspable is, why is that baby crying? You don't know. So you have to be able to tolerate that, you know, long enough to transform yourself to be more intelligent. So in his life, Diamond Shoe must have done things that were karmically beneficial for him. You know, he wasn't a totally closed up, egocentric person. When the woman said that to him, instead of reacting with anger or defensiveness, he was willing to engage with the ungraspable. You know, the ungraspable. And he turns to her and he says, you know, basically, wow, you know, who is your teacher? Where did you learn that? You know. And basically she says, you know, there's a temple not far from here, and there's a teacher whose name is Old Ryotan, and he is my teacher. So, you know, Diamond Shoe has to put aside all his preconceptions and all his advanced degrees. And he goes up to this temple and he starts studying there like an ordinary monk. See, just an ordinary monk. You know, he's the president of, you know, Princeton University, and he has a distinguished chair in Buddhology. But he just, you know, puts his commentaries in the corner and puts on his monk's robe and, you know, shows up to do his work in the afternoon and do his zazen in the evening. And he starts studying with Old Ryotan. And when he goes to the temple, they stop calling him Shu. They give him the name Tokusan. So, you know, he's had a change of heart because he's been willing to tolerate the ungraspable. And he goes to, but he's still Diamond Shoe, right? He spent 30 years studying the sutras, so it's hard for him to be in the ungraspable for too long. So you know, he immediately reverts to his old habits of interpreting everything and thinking things through. And so when he goes to Dokusan, you know, Old Ryotan knows that this is going to be a long Dokusan, right? Now, you know, some teachers are very, very unwilling to have a Dokusan like this. So, you know, my teacher Genki Roshi, whom I loved so much, would just cut you off. If he felt you weren't getting somewhere, he'd just ring the bell and that was the end. So sometimes I'd just start talking and he'd ring the bell. It's like, that's it. Enough. Back to the cushion, right? And so, you know, that was Genki's style, right? And he was a wonderful teacher. But you know, Old Ryotan's willing to sit there and let Tokusan go on and on. So he's given Tokusan a koan and saying, so, you know, tell me about the koan. And yeah, blah, 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 blah. And it's like this sutra and it's like that sutra. And so this koan begins sort of in the middle, like in a movie. It's a scene. And in the scene, you know, Tokusan is rambling on and on and on and on, and Old Ryotan is sitting there patiently wishing this guy would remember the ungraspable. And then finally, you know, Tokusan runs out of steam and he says, well, I think that's all I have to say. And then he's shocked because he's about to leave and he opens the blinds and he says, oh my God, it's night. I've been talking for hours. And Old Ryotan says, oh, it is night. Yes, I see, you know. Let me get you a candle. And this time they made candles out of like a very tightly wound paper. So he gets a candle and lights it and hands it to Tokusan. And then as Tokusan takes the candle, Ryotan just leans over and blows it out. And at that moment, Tokusan has an awakening experience, a kensho experience, because his mind becomes completely blank. Completely blank. Wu-sheen. 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 You know, this is the first time he's had a deep experience of wuxin, that the ungraspable, right? So, you know, the thing is, we have two different kinds of intelligence. And in the modern world, one of those intelligences is very highly developed, right? It's the discriminating mind. And it's a good thing, too. You know, I hope that the guy, when I take my car in, I hope he has a discriminating mind and he can fix what's wrong, right? But there's this other intelligence, right? And it begins when we inhabit that empty mind. That empty mind. Wuxin, wuxin. And, you know, the Zen view is that there are two minds, we say little mind and big mind. And little mind is the mind that, you know, basically thinks in ideas, right? It's the mind that says, I have to get this paper done for the conference in, you know, a month. But there's this other intelligence, which is, you know, basically which we use to deal with the ungraspable. And we call that the big mind. And these two minds are hooked together, but, you know, because of the way we've been raised in our culture, we're very unintelligent about big mind, right? We only live in a small mind world most of the time. And so our world is very small indeed, you know. Big mind is like the supercomputer, right? It's like the supercomputer. And little mind is like, you know, your iPhone, basically. And people spend all their time on their iPhone, and they don't understand that they have access to this supercomputer, right? That takes in so much more information, so much processes much more deeply and profoundly, right, than the small mind. And most of us live in a small mind world in another way too. We sort of, everything we do has like a small mind motivation. So, you know, I have to do this tomorrow. I have to do that, you know, that my boss, and we have to live, we have to pay the bills. But, you know, every once in a while, you do something because you don't know why. I don't know why, I just have to do this. You know, so there were many reasons not to get up this morning. Why did you come to sit? You know, why did you come to sit? And if you say, oh, I came to sit because I want enlightenment, that's just, who the hell knows what enlightenment is, right? I mean, do you know? You know, why did Diamond Shu go to study with old Ryotan? He could say, well, I don't, he'd have to tell you the truth. I don't know. I don't know. And that was the beginning of his liberation, of his encounter with big mind. See, in Zen, we try to spend more time in big mind than in small mind. Yeah, so it's why meditation practice is so important. Why, like sesshin, is so important. You know, spend a lot of time in big mind. And at first, you know, you're like a little mind looking at big mind. So when you first encounter that blankness at the core of your awareness, you know, it just might seem like just a snap. You just have this experience. At the end of your breath, your mind is blank. But if you keep going back there, it gets bigger and vaster and vaster and vaster. And you just have to stay in that blankness, right? And at some point, you know, you begin to be able to be, you develop tolerance for the ungraspable. Not only that, you begin to receive instructions from your big mind. Yes. Instructions. They aren't in language. They aren't in words. It doesn't go, you know, do this, you know. Because that's small mind. Small mind uses language. The big mind doesn't use language. It's pre-linguistic, right? It speaks in a different way, but it definitely speaks. Something spoke to you and said, get up and go to sit this morning. It didn't say, go to sit. You just had to sit, see? And that's your big mind speaking. Now, you know, sometimes, you know, the big mind saying go to sit, and the small mind says, oh, but it's so, you know, it's so nice to sleep. You know, you turn off the, I'll do it next time. But that's not the Zen way, right? The Zen way is to say, yes, master, I am your servant. I will be there. You know, there's a koan where it's called Zuigan calls his master. Zuigan is by himself, but he says, master. And then he says, yes? So it sounds like a schizophrenic episode, right? He says, are you there? And then he says, yes, I'm here. It's kind of funny, but it's the human reality is that we have a small mind that says, I am Kurt. And we have another mind, which is this great emptiness. And the pity is, from the Zen standpoint, the pity is people spend 99 and 9/10 of their time in life in the small mind and very little time in the big mind. But the big mind is the big mind, the small mind is a wave on the ocean of the big mind. The small mind's like one little wave on the ocean of the big mind. So, what a pity, right? What a pity. So good you got up. And Ryotan has just begun to discover this. He's just begun to realize, you know, he had this experience where he suddenly realized, wait a minute, the small mind's almost nothing. It's the big mind, you know, acting from the big mind is the Zen way, is the Zen way. And he's deeply learned it. He's had a deep experience of wuxin, of empty mind. And the next day, Ryotan gets up to give a taisho, and he says, you know, there's a guy in this room, and everybody knows he means Tokusan. He said, you know, when he is in emptiness, he is in emptiness. You know, when he's in deep wuxin, you could hit him with a stick and he wouldn't even notice. You know, that's deep wuxin, all right. But it's definitely accessible. That state of emptiness is accessible to all of us. The next day, Ryotan ascended the rostrum and said, I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. In other words, he's like a vampire of Zen. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Sounds strange, but he says he's no longer a human being, basically. He is now something, a strange creature who lives in the ungraspable. If you strike him with a stick, he won't turn his head to look at you. You know, some way or other, he will climb the highest peaks and establish the Dharma there. Tokusan then brought his notes on the, this is his life's work, right? To the front of the hall, pointed to them with a torch and said, you know, even if you write 20 volumes, it's just like taking plucking a hair from your head and throwing it into the Grand Canyon. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it's like a drop of water in the great ocean. And he burned his notes. And then taking his vows, he made leave of his teacher and the koan ends there, but he actually went back and continued to train. And as usual, Mumon's comment is complimentary. When he says, coming to Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it, he means it was very beneficial. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones because he had gone beyond words. As for Ryutan, he seems to have lost all shame. In other words, he was a very effective teacher. And he lighted the fire in his student, and then he says he poured muddy water on it, meaning don't get attached to the metaphor of fire. Okay. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce means this was a great moment of awakening. Mumon's verse, hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. So seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes.